Like plants that stick to you?
Plants that sting you if you
Yes.
touch them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes,
They're like
absolutely.
weeds. Yeah. I
Yes.
wasn't sure. Different plants, different environments and all that
Yeah.
sort of
Oh,
stuff.
yeah.
I get
Well,
stung by one today in my
oh,
garden because I
shit.
was wearing
Ooh.
shorts. That's all right. When I was a kid, I fell into a batch of them, so it wasn't as bad as that, but it's just annoying. I haven't been stung by one for about 20 years.
All right, let's see if this works out the way that I hope it does. It did. It worked out exactly the way I thought it would. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to something brand new, the Genreverse Battle World Podcast, GV's Battle World Podcast. What the hell is that? We decided that there's a few of us here that like war movies. The Genreverse Podcast Network is about broadening our horizons, and damn it, fucking war movies are a genre. So let's talk some war movies. One of the cool things about this podcast and the idea behind it, and the three of us that are involved, myself, Kyle, I'm also joined by Shocky. What's up, bud?
Not too much. How about y'all?
Doing good. And of course, our other cohort from the Cantina podcast, our Star Wars podcast, Cam Clark.
Hi.
And each of us kind of brings a little something different to the point of view of war movies. All three of us, first off, are huge film buffs. So like the technical stuff, your cinematography, acting, writing, things like that. We can discuss things like that. Shockey teaches history. He's studied history in academia. He's got that book learning. I have a military background, both having served myself as well as grown up with a Cold War era soldier f father. And then Cam is Scottish, so no,
Yeah, well, they
That
say
works
that
itself.
there was some famous general once said that the greatest army in the world would have American technology, German commanders, and Scottish infantrymen.
I was
So.
also going to point out that Cam does have some experience in was it TV production or film production? A little bit experience, like in the writing
Yeah,
side of
a
things.
little bit on the writing side, yeah.
And some of the best historians out there are the armchair historians. They're the ones that will one day write to a journal and get published and become the next big name you see on TV or something. And a lot of them might just have a simple, bachelor's degree, might not even have a de degree. So there's awesome things that each of us are bringing to this, a passion for history, a passion for
Yeah, I'm a bit of a history buff as well, when especially when it
exactly.
comes to some of the wars, actually, which I think are especially World War II, which I find a fascinating subject. I could
Yeah.
watch documentaries on that all day long.
That's what I meant by the armchair
Yeah,
historian is
I
the
guess.
hi
Yeah.
history buff. Yeah. That's what my dad was. He's a history teacher too. And I told him that he couldn't call himself a historian though until he was published.
Yeah.
Or he got his doctorate.
Did he
And
do both?
he's been published and he's working on his doctorate. So he
So
is a
he's a story.
historian now. Yes.
Yep. That's the ongoing joke for the history majors in college, that you are just a guy who graduated with a history degree, but not a historian until you get published. That
Yeah.
that
Or you
is
get the
truth there.
PhD. The
And it's
PhD
funny when
or the
it
PhD,
comes to
correct, yeah.
movies, because strictly speaking,
Because you're gonna
movies
get
don't
published anyways
have to
that
be
way. Yeah.
sort of historically accurate, do they? A war movie doesn't have to be historically accurate,
Nope.
but at the same time, sometimes when it's so obviously not, it can ruin the film as well.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, Enigma, which was particularly offensive to the British because they basically just decided to pretend that it was Americans that got a hold of and cracked the Enigma code machine in World War II, you know. So that might kind of play well on an American an audience that doesn't know their history. But, you know, once you play that over in the UK, people are going to be like, wait a minute, I don't like this now, you know. So there are sometimes situations where historical accuracy can be important in a war movie as well.
Yep. Most John Wayne movies are not historically accurate. I mean,
is that a fact?
Yeah.
I've seen a few of them. My dad is a massive John Wayne fan, mostly the cowboys, but I've seen the odd war movie. But I think at the time of those, though, they were more like propaganda movies.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
You know, basically, which the other sides were doing as well. It's just, you know, our side won. And, you know, obviously American films became part of kind of pop culture all over the world. So we remember those ones more, but that was done, you know, Russia did the same thing. Germany did the same thing when it comes to sort of propaganda war movies.
So, yeah, that, you know, we're all bringing these unique things and points of view to the podcast. And it's not going to be a cantina style for those of you that know what the cantina is. It's not going to be a cantina style review. We're not going to go step by step, but we're going to be talking about Saving Private Ryan today. Today marks 77 years since Operation Overlord, since D-Day, as it's commonly known. June 6th, 1944.
I think when it comes to D-Day movies, that's the one that sticks in your head, because it's not a particular thing that was covered in a lot of the bigger movies before, is it?
Was it the longest day?
Yeah,
the longest day. Yeah,
but like Cam was saying, there were more propaganda films. It was more like boosting it up. Yeah,
you know, the technical know-how at that point to like really immerse you in to what that was like. So the first time we had really, you know, you hear it talked about, you hear people talking about what happened, especially on Omaha Beach. But you didn't really get an idea of what it was like until you saw Saving Private Ryan's opening, I don't think.
So that's kind of like the first thing I wanted to kind of talk about was our first time seeing this. This film came out in 98. It got nominated for 11 Academy Awards, which is awesome. It only won 5. Lost Best Picture to Shakespeare in Love, which was garbage.
Oh, it's an Oscar for you.
Spielberg did get his second director's Oscar for this film. I saw it with my dad. You know, he was an infantryman. He was in the 101st. He knows all about the units there, the 501st. You know, my dad was in 187th, 327, and 50 Deuce. He actually did 3 different times at Campbell with the 101st. Anyways, and so we went and saw it. We were at Fort Benning while he was in drill sergeant school, and there were some older people there, and a lot of tears and all the media hype that you heard about what this movie was doing to people that had either lived it or even people with what we call PTSD these days from Vietnam and Desert Storm, not being able to sit through the film. And even for my dad, it was a tough film for him to watch, but it was such an engrossing movie. And I'm a Tom Hanks fan. I'll watch him sit in a chair for 2 hours.
Yeah, I got you with that. Yeah,
you know, but his story, his reactions, and someone whoever wrote his character is obviously inspired by Colonel Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain from the 20th Maine in the Civil War, because they have a lot in common. But yeah, man, it was an impactful movie, not just to see, but see the reactions around me. I don't know. What about you?
But I think that, you know, if a war movie doesn't kind of almost disturb you in some way, it isn't hard to watch, especially for someone that's had service, then it's not quite doing its job right. Does that make sense?
Because we shouldn't
trivialize, you know, war in that way. It shouldn't be, I don't think, just entertainment. And it's not as entertaining, but it's not entertainment if you take my meaning. you know, Saving Private Ryan. It doesn't kill punches.
Great army movie. Every soldier loves it. Stripes. It's stupid funny.
Yeah.
We absolutely love it. Because the Marines, they get all the films because they're star, you know, limelight hogs. But the Army, we're like, fuck it, man. We're too busy working to bother with Hollywood shit. So we got Stripes. But yeah, you're right. This type of movie, it needed to send a message, and god damn, dude, Spielberg did it.
I think what's special about this movie too is really the first 15 minutes. You know, D-Day itself was only 15 minutes or 15, 20 minutes of this movie right off the bat. And then that was the most action we get in the movie until the
machine gun nest.
Until we get the, you know, the very end when they meet Private Ryan. And from, you know, from the studies I've done in World War II and stuff, it was pretty much a reality for a lot of U.S. soldiers, because U.S. soldiers didn't really enter the war till the latter part of it, where Germany had basically already been hunkered down. So it was more, all right, get to a place, battle, boom, take over that area, march, get to another area. It wasn't constant conflict. It wasn't constant war. And so that's where I've appreciated, or I've at least talked to, you know, World War II veterans who appreciated this film, was that it wasn't all action, that it was a lot of, we have our action moment.
Yeah. There was a lot of downtime.
Yep. And then you have your downtime.
To go from one place to the next. And it was all about speed as well. It was all get to where they need to get quickly.
Get to the next point.
It was ultimately, it was the Nazi tactics of blitzkrieg in reverse. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? That they employed, whereas the Nazi kind of took the defensive position. But Jesus, I mean, compared to in all the beaches that Allied forces landed on, you know, if you're going to show one on film, it has to be Omaha Beach, right? Because the amount of lives lost in Omaha Beach compared to all the other landings, it just dwarfs them completely, because they were not as bad as that anywhere else, because the Germans weren't prepared, you know. And it was just America, really, that was, unless I'm wrong about this, that were in Omaha Beach, you know. So the Americans did get the worst of that, the kind of German defences, by landing at that kind of particular point, compared to, you know, British, Canadian, all that sort of stuff, which had landings elsewhere, which were, I mean, they were still defended, but not as extreme as that. And there wasn't anywhere near the kind of amount of lives lost as there was in Omaha.
Yeah. Luckily, D-Day itself, and they kind of show a little bit throughout the story when they're like looking for Ryan. They run into the lost paratrooper, you know, he missed his point. They run into the crashed aircraft and the crew, and they're like, yeah, we dumped them somewhere. They touch on that a little bit. Like, people don't realize how much went into Overlord. We actually floated a dead body with fake documents to convince the Germans that we were going to go further towards Calais, right?
Cali.
There you go.
Because that was the most obvious, because it was the shortest distance.
Exactly, and it did work a bit.
Patton,
they did focus
Patton,
a bit.
Had a fake army in Britain as well. So he was in charge of the inflatable army.
Correct.
You know, they used to make it look as if they were playing, whereas the real army was all kind of hidden away and everything. It was an absolutely huge effort. And there has never been an invasion like that in history or since, again, you know, a water-based sort of land invasion. And maybe the way modern technology is now, that never will happen again. You'll never have something
like that,
you know. Right. So it really was a one-off, you know.
The weather played a big factor in the casualties sustained on the beach, because the weather is what kept the boats from softening up anti-air batteries and the beach defenses themselves.
And they were a day late launch as well, because they had to go. And it just became that. Yeah.
So that anti-air, of course, if you've seen the Band of Brothers series, you guys know what the AA did, and a little bit in this movie, that meant that the come from behind and take out targets didn't happen as efficiently as we had hoped, and the naval bombardment wasn't as effective on the beaches as we hoped, and not all the beach landings happened on time.
Yeah, a lot of the technology didn't work as well, like a lot of the getting the tanks off and on, a lot of them sunk straight to the bottom, because this was brand new technology designed just for this. No one had ever done anything like that before.
Just practice runs and some
and it's just not the same as actually, you know, going over the English Channel, you know, which is still a massive body of water. As a human, as you sit and go over a boat, it's not. It looks small on a map, but geez, you know,
Mike.
And you kind of see it at the, you know, in throughout the movie, is that or the, you know, on D-Day part of Saving Private Ryan, is that the Germans were prepared for that, because the last that they see of the British, you know, is Dunkirk.
Yeah,
Dunkirk is, they evacuate and come back over, and so
other than in Africa, 2 years, because we were still
right in Africa, right, of course,
but in Europe,
Hitler basically, you know, saw them leave, you know, from Dunkirk was the last of the British, and so he knew that he had to protect the beaches, and so they made these massive, you know, shells, you know, what is it called? Like, I always call them the jack spikes. To prevent, you know, any tanks, you know, coming back up on the beaches. And then, of course, you know, all the artillery that was basically stationed there. So ready for at any point. But you know, to organize that big of an operation, to organize anything that extreme was just it's never going to happen again in history.
You can't. And also what the Germans couldn't do was completely man the entire French coast.
Correct.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So they had to choose where to focus the forces and where they had less. And that was a big part of it, because if we had launched into somewhere where they were expecting us, casualties, would have been crazy, and it potentially would have failed.
Hey,
guys, I just stopped our videos because the audio started getting choppy, but we're still good. Keep going.
Okay. Yeah. And so, like, when you talk about technology, like the limited amount of technology with no tanks and everything, you see that in Saving Private Ryan, where as they storm the beach and they're trying to break through on the first ridge, they have to break through that fence, but they have to use basically pipes and, you know, and try to dig a hole through it so that they can lean and basically send explosives over to kind of blow up an area so that they can start walking through and getting into that the second wave of where the heavy artillery that the Germans had basically stationed themselves on. So, like, you're right, basically everything that had been planned on doing, whether it was coming in from behind, whether it was air support, tanks, basically went out the window, and it was more improvised than anything else. And that was a good thing that Spielberg showed, because previous movies didn't really show that. Didn't really show how, you know, lot of the leaders, you know,
because you wouldn't have done that in a propaganda type film. You don't
show
the mistakes, do you? You don't show stuff failing, because, you know, we're the good guys. We never get anything wrong.
Good guys, that's not true. Couple good guys fall down and then get up and carry on. Do you guys know the one big glaring unrealistic thing in this entire scene is? It's the underwater bullet damage.
Yes, yes.
The underwater bullets lose so much energy
speed
the moment they hit water. Mythbusters took a Mod Deuce style, well, they use a sniper version, but a 50 caliber rifle and shot it and just watched it lose all of its energy within a matter of inches to like a foot. And it was done. Like, you could have, like, just patted it away like you were an anime character.
And from the distance that they were firing upon, too, it would, the bullets would have had very little impact on.
But
I remember reading it
added to the horror of the scene.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
No escape. Like, no escape.
I forgot what book
it was.
What
I liked is that they showed. It's really horrific, but they showed people just drowning under the weight of their equipment.
That's what
absolutely did happen. Yeah. You know,
that was the big key there, was that the amount of weight that those soldiers were carrying on their on their sacks and everything. That's what ultimately led to their to their demise.
That was a huge issue. So there's no denying the realism of the scene, minus that the horrors of people picking up limbs, the shell shock moment that Tom Hanks's character has, the captain has, where he just sees everything going on and then it clicks. Okay, time for action, time for move. Mm-hmm. The medics getting mad at the loss of life. And one thing to remember, especially later on in the movie with Giovanni Ribisi's medic character with Doc, U.S. Army medics are combatants. Now, they're marked as medical staff because in the rules of engagement, you're not supposed to target medical staff unless they are targeting you. So correct. That means if you're fighting a state opponent that's following the so-called rules and they see a medic working on someone, they're not supposed to shoot that medic. Now, if that medic picks up and returns fire, the medic's now no longer performing medic duties and is a target. They have this mission, this drive, though. I've known several medics, including a ranger medic, and just that drive of the patient, that is their sole mission when they're gearing up to go outside, and if shit hits the fan, it's that patient, all else be damned. And those are some of my, you know, the most harrowing moments, but some of my favorite moments are with the medics losing patients, fighting to stay with a patient that's still alive because they just want to try to save one. Just, oh, God.
But just having to make decisions as well to move on to people that got a better chance of survival and who doesn't, you know. And
usually the battalion surgeon, the officer, not the enlisted medic that gets to do that, or the senior medic, the guy that's got the experience. Then that's that scene where he's like, this one's gone, Mark tourniquet. Yeah, this one, you can help me, maybe. Yeah, that's... triage, man, it's
that's the toughest to me. Like, there's no way I could do triage. There's no way. Like, I give all my respect to any medic in any service.
You know, they have to turn it off because if they don't, someone else dies. They lose everyone. You know, they've got, you know, if 50 men get injured and they save 30, you know, that's a good shift. But if they didn't do a triage system, maybe they only save 10. Because they don't get to someone else quick enough, you know, and you just can't do that. So it's just part of the training, isn't it? I suppose
it is these days.
I mean, even doctors in hospitals are similar, you know, in some ways. You know what I mean? They have to switch off the kind of emotional side and just, you know, you're just a patient. You're just a problem, and you know that's the way they have to think about it. You know, to get through the day. I think sometimes.
Yeah. So, moving on a little bit from D-Day, you know, the whole mission here basically is they took the true story of the Sullivan brothers, a group of Navy brothers that all perished on the same boat. Really, really, really terrible idea. It helped the military institute a Last Souls Survivor program, which does not mean that you cannot be drafted and does not mean that you cannot serve. There are things that can be done, and yes, you can still serve your country even if you are the very last person in your family. There's just additional paperwork for it. But it was a terrible thing, and what the military did do is it tried to make sure it split siblings up. And that's what happens with the Ryan brothers. They were split up, but they all were part of Overlord, except for one. One was in Africa and died a little bit earlier. Correct. But two of them died in Overlord, with the third one lost. And now a mom is going to get three folded flags and has no idea about her fourth son. And so they tasked Tom Hanks, Captain. I keep wanting to say Hillard. That's freaking Will Smith in Independence Day. Miller, yeah. Captain Miller.
Oh, that's a different movie we can do exactly. on. That's a different war movie we're going
but,
on there.
Captain Miller, they basically say, hey, pick the cream of your crop, a squad plus, and let's go get this guy. He's dropped back there somewhere. And get him home. And mm-hmm. it's coming from the chief of staff. You know, this is going to happen. I'll tell you what, let's mention the cast here, guys. We get to see young, like, Vin Diesel, young Adam Goldberg, Giovanni Ribisi, Ted Danson is in this movie.
It's a great cast.
Giamatti's in this movie. And, dude, Nathan Fillion as the wrong Private Ryan.
Right. Listen, like, so.
It's so sad, but
this movie
is so funny in it.
Yeah, this movie and then Black Hawk Down have the two most amazing casts mm-hmm. of actors. Like, they were put in there before they hit their prime. Basically, you know, you have Tom Hanks in his prime, but everyone in this movie, you have a young Matt Damon who is. Yep. Yet to hit his, you know, his stride. Vin Diesel, you know, like you said, this cast was amazing. Adam Goldberg, who's going to find, you know, success later on in the Goldberg TV show and stuff. And but yeah, it's unbelievable. The only person that I think that was missing from this movie was Ben Affleck. So
yeah, but he was busy trying to do the Thin Red Line, Pearl Harbor. Which I did not like as much. But this
Pearl Harbor after that was a couple
Pearl
years.
Harbor. Yeah, he got his war movie later.
Not a good one.
But both times he played over in the Pacific. See, that's the problem, playing over there with the Navy and the Marines. Go Army. Anyways, so our group of Rangers, and for those of you that don't know, the Rangers have a very storied past in the United States Army, going back to the Revolution. They are special operations to a degree. Their elite infantry unit, light infantry unit in the United States Army. They're badasses. I love working with and around them.
I mean, at that point in time in World War II, the Americans didn't have special forces,
no,
so they would
like
have been
now.
The special forces.
They were,
you know,
the special
because
forces.
Really, it was in World War II the idea of special forces was kind of invented in the
and
first place. You
your
know, the
SAS
SS, so, yeah.
helped spawn. The Rangers
became,
who helped
yep.
create the training regimen for the Green Berets, and those guys
and
helped create the
and
SEALs
all that
and
sort of stuff.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, it's just advancement of warfare. Yeah,
but all of it can go back to these Rangers, and I, you know, there's a medal that you get for doing your job well, not like super well. I'm saying like, oh, hey, you finished under budget or you know behind. Are ahead of schedule. So
right.
there's something called the Army Achievement Medal. Sometimes they mean a lot because you did something extra beyond your nine to five, right? And they mm-hmm. award it for you, and you're like, yeah, hey. Other times it's like, yeah, you did your job and you did it well. Okay, sure, I'll take it. I got one from the Rangers, from the 75th Ranger Regiment. Because I kind of was pawned off on them for 4 months to do work on a base, a special base in Afghanistan. But for me, it was just the experience of a lifetime for 4 months to get to play JSOC. Basically, I didn't wear my normal uniform. I didn't shave. I didn't, you know, I had a sidearm and some khakis, and it was great experience and a wonderful chance to see that side of the Army. Mm-hmm. But the Rangers, the they are more of the story. This group is more of the story than Ryan ever could be. And throughout it, the points that I love the most are them walking and talking. The fact that they have a pool on what their captain's job was and what his home is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They curse at each other. They do everything that me and my brothers and sisters did in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, whether we mm-hmm. were in a stressful combat situation like my first time in Iraq, or even the laid back construction times when, or deconstruction of Afghanistan in 2013. Both times, man, you're still dealing with crappy living conditions away from friends and family. You can't easily fix a faucet at home, stresses and things like that. And this movie, again, like Captain America and the Winter Soldier, Captain America and the Winter Soldier, Falcon and the Winter Soldier, this did such a great job of just showing you guys, we are that fucked up. We are that dark. And yes, the scene with the dog tags, you would have to get some of us to stop doing it because we're so out of it that we're not even realized that the people around us aren't desensitized yet. It happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think about stuff like that?
I've never been in the military. I've known a lot of my friends did go into the military, and exactly as you say, these are the people with the darkest humors, out of everyone, especially the one that was in the Navy, because you just cooped up my boat with people and in those days in the Navy, you didn't get women in the boat really or anything like that. So, it was obviously different days. So, to me, it was just like, you're just a bit fucked up in the head, to be honest. But, when you're in that environment, it's just, it's different, And one of my friends who, was in the Navy, he really missed it, And mm-hmm. and when he was 40, he ended up joining the sort of Territorial Army, which is, para regiment, which is, and now he goes, various places and jumps at airplanes, etc. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And, because I think he just kind of missed that whole camaraderie that you get from the military, and he just wanted that back before he was too old to be able to do it, kind of thing, and he ended up in Afghanistan in his 40s, so.
Yeah, the private security, a.k.a. mercenaries, which I'll tell you what, Cam, I did a job for some Aegis cats, there's some good dudes. It was two Londoner Brits, one Aussie, and one Scottish guy mm-hmm. working for Aegis over there. I'm not sure if the name rings a bell, but they're a private security firm or were. Anyways, Mike, your thought on these in between the walking, Captain Miller starts berating his soldiers or starts talking shit about the mission without talking shit about the mission because he's an officer. He doesn't bitch down. He bitches up.
Right, exactly. Like that was a key point and key element that I think most people can relate to, is that when you bitch about an assignment that you get, whether in your office job or in the military, you don't bitch downwards, you bitch upwards and stuff. And so when they try to get Captain Miller to talk about how the mission is FUBAR, and stuff, mm-hmm. it's he's like, no, I'm not going to do that because that's not the way it goes. It goes upwards, not downwards. And so, but I think. What the movie does a great job of is showing that brotherhood, like you're talking about there. And I think that anyone who has played sports, who has been in, some type of, camaraderie of a club scouts, or anything like that. Yeah, scouts are in it. You know that kind of bondage that you build in that time. And, and the military shows the greatest example of that. And, you see, veterans today, that bond that they share, whether it's them, acknowledging by, having a hat on or something, recognizing that they served in the military, you see that bond as they walk by each other and recognize each other and just give that certain nod and everything. That's ultimately what this movie does, is it shows that this was, it shows that this was a regular men, Miller was, Kevin Miller was a teacher, English teacher, right? And that were drafted into this war, that they answer the call of duty, they go and serve, and, most of them, end up, making it back to the United States. But those who don't, there's that burden of carrying, that you were with those men in their last days, in their last moments, and that you carry it with it for the rest of your life. And that's what the movie shows. I was watching one podcast that Spielberg does a great example of this, or you know, of tricking the audience, because at the beginning of the movie, we think that the old gentleman who's visiting the funeral scene, or not the funeral, Arlington, Virginia, mm-hmm. and we think that's Tom Hanks.
Oh well, and he's in. I thought they were. He's in the cemetery in France. He's in
that's right. You're right. Yes, you're right. Cemetery in France, and you know, we think that's Tom Hanks, when, because he does a great transition mm-hmm. from close up on the eyes of the older gentleman to Tom Hanks, but then we realize that this is Private Ryan, that who is carrying that burden, that this man sacrificed his life so that I could have a family, and I could have grandkids, and I could see myself become old. And that's what any type of bondage is, and in the military is the best example of that. And this movie does a great job. I think Spielberg did a great job of showing why, you know, that generation above and beyond is the greatest generation to ever, you know, be a part of human history, and sacrifice, you know, the future they have. Because I mean, look, you think about it, Captain Miller was an English teacher living his life. He, you know, World War II doesn't happen, or his number doesn't get called.
Yeah, I mean, these were people who chose military careers. That didn't, you know, that's not what World War II was. World War II was, we have to get everybody who's fucking fit to get out there, you know, because if we don't, we're going to get fucked.
Yeah.
And you know, that's just what it was. Unless you did a job that was needed back home, like my paternal grandfather never went to the war, but actually died anyway. And it was because he was a steel worker. So you couldn't send steel workers because that was something that was needed, and it wasn't a job that they could get the women to do at the time. So he didn't go, and he ended up dying before the war was over because of an accident at the steelworks anyway. Do you know what I mean? But my dad's stepfather that then married his mum, you know, later, he was over in the war. He was a desert rat. So he kind of went, not in D-Day, but he went from Africa up the way through Italy.
Oh, wow.
You know, kind of they did that, the whole Monte Cassino thing and all that. So he kind of did that. And then my maternal grandfather, he wasn't at D-Day because he was on boats. He was Navy. So they did the Russian runs to supply the Russians, where they were getting attacked by sort of subs all the time and everything like that. But
they were playing up there in the Arctic.
I mean, these are not military people. Do you know what I mean? They're not, but they all had to just do what they had to do to win that war, ultimately.
It's interesting. And when we come back from this real quick spot from our sponsors, Grow Generation, I'll point out something that changed shortly after World War II.
Grow Generation, where the pros go to grow. Grow Generation is your one-stop shop for hydroponic grow supplies, product systems, and more. Grow Generation serves customers across the nation and carries a wide inventory of renowned cultivation brands. Go to www.growgeneration.com, where the pros go to grow.
All right, thanks for that, Grow Generation. Please go check them out. So one of the things a lot of people notice in this movie is you got this captain running things, and in the modern army, that's not the way it is. The non-commissioned officer corps, the modern version of it, came about because of the epic amount of stress and failure of what they put on the majors and below. So you're talking your battalion XOs and below during Vietnam and World War II, and I guess you could say Korea, but Korea is really just an extension of World War II to a degree. And they really changed things up today. Your platoon leaders are there and usually on ground. They'll be in vehicles on patrols with you and whatnot. But they still do a majority of an admin thing. They're the legal authority. a captain at a company level, and when you're talking about operating army, so your infantry, cav scouts, your tankers, even your engineers, combat, construction, things like that, the captain is almost all admin, very, very little command, actual movement of troops, other than like picking which platoon is going to do which project, which he's going to take the advice of the lower his subordinates, his platoon leaders on that. And
I think in World War II, America didn't have time for any of that.
They basically, the reason why Captain Miller is a captain in this case is he had a college degree. It was really the World Wars going and saying, oh, college educated people are more likely to be smarter, which we all know is that an academic pedigree does not mean intelligence.
Correct.
or wisdom. But that's why he basically went through the ranks and ended up an officer. He had a degree. Think about that. English teacher, officer, and not only that, but you happen to be naturally physically fit and a good shot. So Ranger infantry officer, holy fuck.
I mean, you got to think about how, like, the today to be an officer, what it takes. I mean, it's more than just having a simple degree. I mean, if that was the case, how many people would go in the military so that they could get the pay of an officer? I mean,
someone once asked why wouldn't you want to be an officer, because they make more money? And the simple fact is what do you want to do? Because no matter what, at one point in your career, you're going to become an administrator at a battalion, brigade, division, mm-hmm. division level. That's part of your career path. Even if you want to be a command sergeant major, in your career on the enlisted side, that's the highest rank at, you know, depending at what level, but that's the top. You're going to do stints of admin staff positions, years of it, and
most of these people just don't want to be pen pushers. I mean, most people don't join the military and sit behind a computer desk.
The transition to that admin part happens in the officership a lot faster and is almost permanent. So it's like you only get to place soldier, so to speak, in the officer world for a few years. So when you're looking, and I almost sound like I'm almost recruiting right now, but when you do consider your career paths, there's always that third option nobody really looks at. A lot of jobs have something called a warrant officer, and you don't get to see a warrant officer in this movie, but there are other films
I think one of my granddads was, I think, a warrant officer or something like that in the Navy. I don't know, it'd be a different system, I suppose,
in the U.S. Army. They're usually in the technical jobs, and they're the book experts.
Mm-hmm.
So
he was a former engineer. Why he did that.
They'll come from the enlisted ranks. They only come from the enlisted ranks. You cannot go from commissioned to warrant. Mm-hmm. You can go from enlisted.
Start off enlisted, then go to the school to become an officer and take that path? Yeah.
Absolutely. So anyways, back to the movie, let's talk some war crimes, because we get a machine gun nest scene that really shows us, you know, we talk about the dog tag scene. That's dark humor. They're, you know, risking their life for this one guy. They don't understand this is the unit and they're playing and their buddies' dog tags. These are just pieces of metal with names to them. But here at this machine gun nest, the decision's made. They could theoretically go around. Captain Miller's like, dude, if we do that, what? Leave it for the next, you know, American patrol to be ambushed, because there's a bunch of poor dead 82nd Airborne laying on the ground, and Shockey knows where they're at, right down the road, and yep. and they decide, okay, look, it's part of winning the war, it's part of our mission, and it is the most direct route to our mission. And so they attempt to take out this machine gun nest, and they successfully do at the cost of Doc, Giovanni Ribisi's character, the medic. It's what is his name as T? They just call him. And
I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, T and Doc. And mm-hmm. and it costs him his life, and what they're going to do is they're going to make this German survivor dig everyone's graves for the Americans and then shoot them. But mm-hmm. Upham, the translator, dweeby little translator from way back at the beginning of the movie, basically appeals to the reason, the logic, the human, the rational side of Captain Miller to be like, dude, you know, this isn't the right, this is what they do, not what we do. And, but they can't take him with him. And Captain Miller makes a choice that ends up biting them in the ass. I hate the Upham character all throughout this film, from the time he's introduced to mm-hmm. his so-called redemption, which isn't a fucking redemption. And I don't know why they put it in here, but this type of mentality not only happens, but we know that people have executed enemy combatants that have surrendered to America. Look, here's the thing. Bottom line up front, people, since the first human struck another human, they did it dirty, okay? Mm-hmm. Every country, every nation, every religion, every ethnic group, every civilization has committed atrocities. So there, bottom line up front. But here, we get to see Steven Spielberg say, it wasn't just Nazis. America did some fucked up shit and considered some fucked up shit too. Cam, as the foreigner, and always hearing about the might and the purity of that outside appearance of the military. This is before Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, this is before Iraq and Afghanistan showing some dirty stuff. What did you think?
As someone from Britain, I think we are well aware that it's not as squeaky clean as that. I think there was a romanticism about it for Americans, because you come into World War II, and World War II was a just war where you were attacked, where it was good guys versus bad guys. It was good aspects mm-hmm. of human nature versus the bad aspects of human nature. Yeah. And it was a war we had to fight and that we had to win. So it's one of the few morally sound wars.
If you guys had done your job the first
time,
we wouldn't have had to come back.
Well, it wasn't easy, ultimately, those Germans actually knew how to fight.
We were selling stuff to both sides. It turns out it's not easy.
one of the reasons that, really, Hitler should have been attacking the US anyway, because they were supplying stuff to Britain in the Lend-Lease system, mm-hmm. but Hitler did understand that bringing America in wasn't the right move. He absolutely would have targeted America later on if he had. But he wanted to get Russia out the way, first of all. That was his big target. Go east for Russia. But ultimately, that was his big error as well, because he couldn't do it properly, and all his forces were out in the east getting devastated, and it allowed there to be the chance for us, everybody else to come in from the west coast and get the foothold there. Because if the Germans had not attacked Russia, Russia wouldn't have even been in the war. They would have mm-hmm. just stayed out. They were quite happy to sit out and not get involved. And then all of those Germans that lost their lives, all that money that was spent attacking the east, would all have been focused on defending the west coast, and then you're in a completely different kettle of fish. So there's so many aspects to it. But I think as someone from Britain, we'd been in loads of wars before that, and World War One was just a disgrace of a war. It was fought, what it was fought for, the complete recklessness of how many people were just killed. you know, the things that they use, chemical warfare, and I mean, far more people died in World War One than World War Two, and for what reason? You know, what was the purpose of it? There still, even after it was finished, there didn't seem to be any true purpose other than keeping imperialism. And of course, America were involved in World War One as well, but in a different way, I think. And you know, I think that's what it is, that a lot of Americans then romanticise that we're the good guys. And I think outside of World War II, where that was true, that's not necessarily true of any other conflict, you know, because there's always two sides to any war, you know. And I think, you know, that's just what you have to accept. Oh. And I think as a Brit, I accept that, you know, that's just the case. Sometimes, you know, we're not always in the right all the time. We're not the white knights. Right,
yeah. World War II did have more casualties. The civilian casualties especially upped the numbers in World War II quite a bit.
Sure?
I'm positive.
Worldwide, yes.
Yes, worldwide. 100% certain.
Maybe not in Britain, but worldwide.
Yeah. And again, specific combat aspects, it kind of depends on what you're counting as a combat kill, but worldwide deaths related to the wars, 40 million is like a high estimate, 20 to 40 million for World War One, and 55 to 75, 80 for World War Two.
Yeah, Winston Churchill was kind of the savior for Great Britain by hunkering down and basically, you know, having the air raid system put in place for the Blitzkrieg, mm-hmm. and everything is saved.
Developing radar.
Yeah, developing radar. Right, exactly. Like,
So we knew when they were coming.
Yeah, the French basically got obliterated in World War II.
As the British call them, you know, I don't mean to offend anybody, but that's just, you know, we always have this relationship with France, as we call them French surrender monkeys. So, yeah, I mean, France didn't do great in World War One either, you know what I mean? Yeah. But they were fighting a war that was World War One still, you know, right. And the Germans had advanced, and it was beyond that. And
Polish,
it just fell quickly.
Most of Central Europe basically gets obliterated by Nazi Germany.
Yeah. But this is what France went through leading up to World War One. Okay, the world punished France because of Napoleon, right? Correct. Just like the world punished Germany and
World War
Japan
One, which led
for the
to
World
War Two,
exactly. Yeah. And both of those countries suffered, and to this day, still to a degree, suffer, and are not militaristically capable of defending themselves. A little bit by choice, and a little bit not by choice. So it's an interesting, that is an interesting history repeating itself. The ending of the movie brings us to a big question of what is the mission, what mission matters more? Because when they find Ryan, finally, Matt Damon's Private Ryan, he's joined a group that has been tasked to hold one of two last bridges that both the U.S. can cross to push the invasion forward, but also the Germans could come in and mess things up because the U.S. isn't set up yet. They're not ready yet. And they don't know when the backup is coming, and it's just a rag team to hold it together. So you get this whole thing of Captain Miller's team being like, we lost people to save you. Your mother already has three flags. She wants another. Ryan being like, but what about my mission? What about, you know, these guys that died here for this bridge? And then Captain Miller's idea of the war back at the machine gun nest, you know, this will help us win the war. All of these ideologies, it really gives you an insight to a service member's mind, because we're not all necessarily serving, we're all serving the same cause, but our driving force might not be the same, and our mission might feel differently. Mike, this aspect of the film, learning all of these visions of what the mission is, what's that like for you? And also something I wanted to ask, what do you teach your kids about atrocities America has done in modern history?
So it's interesting. With American history, it's real, like when in teaching it, especially war and conflict, in early American history, you see that there's these generations that go about and they all have their linkage to some sort of conflict where they come out as the victor, as the white knights, you know, right. So the Revolutionary War, early Republic era, you know, War 1812, Mexican-American War, then the Civil War. Okay. So the Civil War was unique because it was the conflict internally. And so it showed that it was a different style of fighting, and it was against brothers, and it was against family members, and it was, you know, internal. So while World War I happened and the United States was taken a part of it, this generation that had taken part in World War I really didn't kind of identify themselves as the saviors, right? And they wanted to, the United States was in a very, an identity crisis. What was going to be the United States? And so for World War II, this was that moment. This was that moment for anyone ages 18 to, I think the oldest that they would enlist in active service was 35. It was their moment to say, look, 80 years ago, you know, roughly, we went through a conflict that, you know, challenged our view of democracy and the vision of what the founding fathers, you know, wanted this country to be. This is that 45. Shining moment. What's that? 45 years ago. And so it's like, this is that generation that's going to show that although we had our issues and although we had our conflict internally, this is what America's about. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to be the saviors. Now, is it clean cut, white and black? We were, you know, the Superman where we do everything by the book and, you know, we don't commit atrocities? No, because war, as we study history in all aspects of it, all around the world, that there is a, you know, war is very gray. You know, there's the aspects of it where, you know, you have to commit some sort of type of, not necessarily atrocity, but you have to bend that line a little bit in order to save, you know, sacrifice few to save millions, right, type deal. And so this is where this movie does that kind of highlight of it, you know, whether it's, you know, Upman, you know, trying to save a Nazi German soldier, or, you know, the do we, you know, sacrifice five men just to save one man with saving Private Ryan, you know, by, you know, Private Ryan and bringing him back home. And, you know, Spielberg shows it. That's why that this generation, you know, around the world was the greatest generation, because they did make that ultimate sacrifice. You, what was it? Five soldiers ended up dying in the movie. What was it? Vin Diesel, six for one man.
Captain. Yeah.
Yeah. Captain Miller. That's right. So six men die for one man. You know, you could have easily left, or the mission could have just easily never happened and said, you know what, this mom's going to get four flags and her four sons died valiantly, you know, saving the world and stuff. And it'd be over with. But what it shows is that, you know, what is it worth to save one man? And you sacrifice six men, but those six men also have to commit certain things that we don't necessarily accept outside of war. Now, inside of war, if you serve, like, that's why I think in wartime and you're serving and you're in the military and you have to make a judgment call, and it's something of that, you know, where it's not covered by the rules of engagement, then it's very difficult to judge somebody in that moment, you know? And there's, that's where I think this movie does a great, it really challenges that mindset.
I'll say this about it. What it does is it shows something. It shows that even without a well-established ROE, just that general humanity can and does shine through even in dark moments, you know. It also to me shows that in my experience, the idea of fighting a war to win hearts and minds is oxymoron and does correct. Not work. You
correct.
You do one thing with war. You wage it upon your enemy in such a way that they can't wage it back on you. And you hope to make it so terrible no one ever wants to do it to you again. However, I'll quote someone that is very controversial figure in American history, but it is a very poignant quote. Robert E. Lee of the Confederacy did say, "It is good that war is terrible; otherwise, men would grow fond of it." 'Cause look at us here, talking about these beautiful scenes. And I'm a person that has seen, you know, bad situations up close, and even I can get romantic about a war movie. And I can even get romantic about the times when it was like, hey, we just had a 916 get hit. We don't know their status. QRF's rolling out. Let's go. There is a hero moment that happens. And it's never as dramatic as it is in the movies. But there is a certain aspect to this that even when we're there, we can say that we're doing it for all the right reasons, but there is that ego in the background that's like, man, this will make a great book one day.
Yep, you're right.
You know, so they end up staying, of course, to protect the bridge, because that, you know, America's got to win World War II, and you made this bridge a part of America winning World War II. And We see that Captain Miller and team stay to sacrifice, not just for Ryan, because they sit on him. They like block him with their body. They're dragging him all over to keep him safe during this ambush. But at the very end, like you say, when it's revealed that it's Ryan that survived, Captain Miller dies shooting at the tank with his last full measure, man, a fucking pistol versus a tank, mm-hmm. until the Mustangs or Spitfires showed up and started blasting away. This whole final scene to me, first off, I'll say outstanding military advisors here. Your mount training, your movement over urban terrain is on point, guys. I like it. Some of your corners could have been pied better, but good job. the only thing that drags down the end for me is up him, man. I wanted him to just die. I did. I wanted him to either off himself. The fact that he shoots the Steamboat Willie German at the end does nothing for me. As a film moment, as a story moment, I gotta ask you guys, does that work for either of you, Cam?
No.
Mike?
It showed me not everyone was a hero in this war.
Like that part. Him being a coward is great. It's him shooting the German at the end and being like, he's okay.
Yeah, like that to me was, I guess, the redemption piece for Hollywood. You know?
Story writing there.
Yeah, so. Because, you know, if you didn't add that piece in, critics would have been like, how dare you not, you know, Upham was a hero in his own, or not everybody, you know, whatever. Yeah. But it showed me that there was a lot of people drafted or sent over in this war that are not soldiers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's, I keep telling, I have so many battle buddies that served with me that were like, oh, everyone should serve 2 years. I'm like, are you kidding me? No.
No.
Not even all of the fit ones should do it. I can't. I can't.
I don't know. I think, you know, there was something to be said for national service back in the day when I see people that, you know, like, you know, can't be bothered working or getting any jobs. And I think sometimes, I've seen people that join the military and it kind of does sort them out and gives them that work ethic. And it's not as if we're you know, they've necessarily gone into major conflict. You know, you don't need to do that. They could just be in the military and stay at home. You know, they don't have to.
But that's the thing abroad. Here.
There's plenty of service jobs that you could do in for the government or for civil service.
Yeah,
you know, but that you don't need to serve in the military.
The military itself, and this is one thing that a lot of people that don't have either first or at least secondhand experience with the U.S. military. What makes the U.S. military the U.S. military is its training. It's the fact that literally there's only one job that doesn't carry a weapon, and that's the chaplain. Mm-hmm. The chaplain's assistant is a trained killer. While they prepare for communion or for a service and all of that, they are also the ones at the range because they're the chaplain's guard. The U.S. military's training is top notch, and what we can do with a squad, another country needs a platoon, needs 30 people to do what I can do with 12. And it all comes down to technology and training, and it's why we're able to do what we do and be as small as we are. And people are like, oh, but you have, you know, over 500,000 active army alone, you know, 2 million active and reserve total across the board almost. Yeah, that's really small when you consider how many countries we're in, how many service members are stationed abroad, how many fleets we have, the fact that we got 11 carry, like right. It all adds up, and the world benefits from that military projection, and it all came from World War II. You know, this movie, I think I can remember in the 90s, in the late 90s, when this movie came out, the Desert Storm was fairly fresh on people's mind, but it hadn't been Hollywoodized really. Kosovo and Bosnia were on our minds, but those seemed different. You know, they didn't quite seem like a war. And then the closest thing we had was Somalia and Mogadishu with Black Hawk Down, which
Yep.
Terrible. But even that was short. And I think World War II was even kind of fading out of favor. And here comes Spielberg once again, and look, yes, obviously Spielberg being a man of Jewish heritage, faith descent, whatever phrase you choose to use with it, famous for Schindler's List. This movie, The Passion, man, I love it when Adam Goldberg character when he kills the one German, rightfully so, in combat, and he gets the knife off of him. It's a Hitler Youth knife or a Nazi knife, and just the emotion and Spielberg getting to put these stories out there in Hollywood. I think Saving Private Ryan may have revitalized the genre in the 90s. What do you think?
Yeah, there was quite a few films come out after that, you know, which different conflicts, but
Band of Brothers came out after Saving Private Ryan.
I mean, yeah, and that was arguably even better than the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's absolutely great. Do you guys What part of this movie for each of you guys really hits you the most, either from a story film aspect or a history or war aspect? I'll go with you, Cam.
I mean, it's the beginning in terms of the D-Day landing, because, you know, I've read so much about it, I've watched so many documentaries about it, but you just don't quite... That was a film that made you kind of feel like you really were in it. And that was the first time, I think, anything had ever truly done that for me. So, you know, if the movie was just the opening alone and then it was a 20-minute movie, you know what I mean? It would still be a classic.
Mike?
I'm trying to think of the actor's name.
Which character?
The sniper.
Barry Pepper, Private Jackson.
Yeah, Barry Pepper. His character, to me, was the one I always remembered because he was the sniper, but he always did the prayer before, you know, going, and it was kind of that conflict. You know, you're a religious man, you're going, you know, into war, and your job is to kill another man, but you're at the same time keeping your morals and values together and stuff. So it's kind of that. He really stuck out for me because that really showed me that it was like, I was in high school, and it was showing me that, you know, that this was a very conflicted war. That, you know, this was just regular men being called to action, and, you know, and keeping his job in mind, his, you know, keeping the, you know, the men around him protected, you know, but at the same time being a religious man. And so that, I think I'm one of the few people that, you know, think of that when you think of Saving Private Ryan. Of course, you go to D-Day, or, you know, mm-hmm. Tom Hanks' character, mm-hmm. but for my Barry Pepper, for whatever reason, it's just like he stuck with me on that.
I get that, man. I can get that. I'll, you know, give my point on that. My prayer before heading out in Iraq, and the few times I did in Afghanistan, because I didn't go out as much the last two times as I did the first time. And by out, I mean outside of the base, outside of the wire, on a patrol or convoy, whatever. There's so many different terms people use these days versus what we did in 05 and 06. But I usually just said, hey, if I have to shoot, let me hit what I need to hit and get home.
Right.
I'm going to aim. I don't, inshallah, that's the Islamic God will, basically, if God wills it, so God will it. That's how they shoot over there. The insurgents believed in inshallah. They basically, what Americans call pray and spray, right? Or spray and pray. Mm-hmm. I will always aim to hit my target because I don't want to give you a chance to hit me. But I too dealt with that where it's like I don't want to. And when you are presented with when you're presented with that moment, you can be very thankful for training. People think that we're brainwashed in the military. We're not brainwashed at all. Cam's said it earlier. We're taught how to shove certain things down, shunt something away,
right,
to complete a mission.
To do your job.
And then we process it later. And that's called PTSD.
Well, so. If you think about it in modern sports today, think of it like, you know, you're teaching, you know, kids, or, you know, to, you know, whether it's a baseball game, basketball, football, you know, hide your emotions, focus on the, you know, the task at hand, do that, repetition. That was the one thing I learned. Mm-hmm. You know, I got to go to Paris Island for, and kind of observe some of the training that they did there. And it's all repetition and just kind of just instilling it in your brain so that when that time does come, there is no thinking. It's all pure muscle memory and action. And that's what we, you know, in sports, you know, for kids today, that's what it is. It's repetition and practice so that when the mm-hmm. time comes, it's there, you know. It's crazy.
We have a standard ROE procedure, used to be called shout, shove, show, shoot in the Army back in the day. They've changed it multiple times, and it could be – you could cut out some of the S's and rearrange them depending on the situation, but – in training, you always, you know, you're shouting, hey, stop, don't move, don't come any closer, put the weapon down. Showing, you know, hey, I've got a weapon, cock it, you know, go ahead and chamber around, eject one if you'd already had one, just to show them that, yes, this is loaded and ready. Shove if they got too close or something like that. And then, of course, shoot. What people don't realize is that the escalation of force is what that's called. The escalation of force can happen in like 3 seconds from, hey, stop, what you do? Boom, done. Because you literally, as soon as you said stop, they lifted the weapon, and that's it. You didn't even get to go through all of it. But in your brain, you did it. You do it all. And it's an interesting thing. That's why Captain Miller sits there except I'm going to die, but I'm going to die shooting at this tank because that's my job. That's my mission. That's what I'm going to do. And I, my favorite part would have been that, but in all honesty, it's that scene very early on in their mission, walking, bullshitting with each other, and the captain saying, you know, I accept this mission, and I would gladly give my life and the life of my men, especially you Riven, for Private Ryan. I mm-hmm. to me, that is the United States Army. I love it. And I love this.
And the
this
joking around of what FUBAR means.
Yes. Oh God. That's like when you say you get a new private in and you're like doing a project and they don't know all the tools yet. Right. So you're like, hey, right. Private Snuffy, come here. Go ask Sergeant First Class Smith for a Pricky 7. I need a Pricky 7 to do this job. And an E7 is the enlisted pay grade for a Sergeant First Class. So you go ask this Sergeant First Class, hey, can I get a Prick E7, a Prick E7? You get it? And old jokes like that all happen. You can get soldiers to get exhaust mm-hmm. samples from right. trucks. I love it. I love it. So
it's the brotherhood there.
Yeah, that to me is it. And yeah, guys, I just, you know, to all the people that survived D-Day, especially if they're still alive, we couldn't be more humbled by even getting a Hollywood dramatized glimpse of what you went through.
That's true. Yeah.
And I think we could all say bravo and thank you to Steven Spielberg and his team for providing. I definitely put this in my top five war movies of yes. all time.
Yes, okay.
So yeah, I did want to offer with these war movies. I was a construction engineer. My dad was infantry, but I know that a lot of people have questions about military and things like that. And as we do things, if you guys in the comments want to ask anything, feel free to. But did Cam or Mike, you asked some things throughout, but did either of you guys want to ask anything about any tactical stuff or, you know,
not really, because I mean, I understand, you know, because certainly World War II, I understand how, especially that period, D-Day, how it was fought, because there's so much been, I mean, it's been talked about. I mean, I come from Britain, you guys come from America, it's on the TV and always yep. will be, you know. So, you know, historians have studied that conflict. And you know, in a way that we just didn't have really with any previous war, you know. And you know, there's so much footage and everything as well, you know, that they've still got these. It's not necessarily a combat itself, but the kind of after effects, and people are coming into towns and, you know, what it all looked like, and they can colorize it all these days. Yeah. So I don't think so for that, but once we get into kind of different conflicts, I mean, because, you know, certainly I don't have that, I don't understand yeah. military as such, you know, and the likes of the Civil War, for example, in America, that's just a conflict I'm not very familiar with at all, you know.
Yeah, but
don't really learn it at school in our country, you know.
Yep. So I wanted to offer that opportunity for whenever we do these podcasts and things like that. Been a lot of fun, guys. What do you think, Mike?
I think it was a great topic, like great discussion. You know, anytime you can, you know, incorporate history into film is great, and to have a group of men, you know, from different backgrounds talking about and, you know, discussing what they enjoyed from it, and kind of, you know, not necessarily describing what, you know, fact and fiction, but just kind of getting into the brotherhood about it and why this you know, these movies are so well accepted. I'll definitely have more questions for you when we do more modern movies like Black Hawk Down and stuff, because as a history teacher, I was, you know, World War II, Civil War, Revolutionary War. I've got those down. Yeah, that's my bread and butter. But more of the modern war movies, that's where I like, I'm intrigued. And it's like this, you know, where does Hollywood take their liberties away from, you know, the actual real, you know, real life events.
Yeah. And I look forward to that. And hopefully, speaking of the Civil War, like Cam mentioned, next month, for the anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, we'll be discussing the movie Gettysburg.
Which, up front, I have never watched. Yep. So that will be an experience for
Save
me.
Save yourself some time to watch that one.
How long is it?
4 hours.
Really?
Yep. It's 4 hours. But, it's actually a pretty... it's a pretty good 4 hours, isn't it?
No, it's good. It's definitely good. But for, you know, World War II, D-Day is the moment for American Civil War. Gettysburg is it. That's
I get it. You know, I've watched a few documentaries on the Civil War. And, you know, I'm a big fan of The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, which kind of, you know, around that war, but you know, and there's plenty of other cowboy films that have skirted around the war as well. And I've watched, you know, like Custer, you know, and stuff like that. So there's a little bit of I've got that knowledge, but you know, I've never watched Gettysburg. No, probably because you know it was a 4 hour movie and it just maybe didn't play on TV here as a kid. Yeah. You know, maybe as much as it did in America. I don't know.
It's good It's good.
Yeah, it's not on TV much here because of the length of it. But yeah, it's the movie to show kind of the totality of the war. There's other ones that are out that are more recent that I think are better at showing kind of certain aspects of, like, Free State of Jones with Matthew McConaughey does a great example of showing how conflicted the Confederacy was. Like, it wasn't just everyone in the Confederacy was pro-slavery, pro-Confederacy. It shows both sides.
No, and that would be the same one. You know, Lincoln is as well. It wasn't as simple as it.
Yeah, and Lincoln is a good one as well, showing how divided the Union really was and how difficult Lincoln's presidency was.
I didn't watch Lincoln because I have a hate relationship with President Lincoln because you know me, I'm a constitutionalist. So
correct.
So first off, what he did was great. The proclamation was technically unconstitutional, but I'm messing around, guys. I said it was a good thing. Relax. My thing is, I hate that we do not teach in school generally. You got to find special history teachers to say, by the way, while Lincoln was anti-slavery, he was still a white supremacist, did not believe in mixed marriages, and at one time considered recolonizing Africans back to South America and Africa.
Oh yeah, we could go on a long. That's another history movie we can go and analyze down the road.
Again, Lincoln, because he was killed, I think, as deified almost, you know, by Americans is, but you know, humans are humans, and they have good and they have bad points.
Exactly, it's context. You know,
Winston Churchill was, you know, the right man to lead, you know, Britain during World War II.
Right.
But after, when he got the job again later on, he was a failure. He wasn't the right man for, you know, and he was a old-fashioned imperialist and he couldn't get along with the modern world. But for that moment in time, he was the man we needed because we were the fail without him, you know, and it's just, that's the way it goes.
And that's my point, and we'll get to talk about it a lot with Gettysburg, is context. Because in America, we have a discussion right now about whether or not we should have schools named after Washington and Jefferson because of their status as slave owners in the context of the time, while at the same time
we're having the same conversations. Right. You know, like Glasgow is named, every street in Glasgow, which is my closest city in Scotland, is named after slave owners.
Right.
You know, and merchants that were taking slaves to America.
And then you have Lincoln, who is, you know, in presidential debate letters and things like that, saying, the white race is superior. He did at one time consider recalling it. And people don't apply the outrage equally is all. But, yeah. you know, we're getting beyond the topic of the movies and stuff like that. Yeah. So I hope
starting
you guys
to get politics.
Yeah, I hope you guys will continue to enjoy the Battle World podcast here at the Genreverse, brought to you by LRM Online. LRMonline.com is where you can find all of your entertainment news, needs, and opinions, amazing stories, wonderful interviews. We have a crap ton. That's the actual legal definition, a crap ton of podcasts covering Marvel and Star Wars, a daily show called The Daily Cog. We've got Breaking Geek Radio, a lot of really cool things for you guys to check out on the YouTube channel, so make sure you're subscribed there. And subscribe to wherever you get your podcast from to LRM's Genreverse Podcast Network. It's free. All that content, audio only. Don't have to look at my ugly face. Just listen to my terrible voice. I'm at that Kyle Malone on Twitter. Shockey, tell us a bit about you and anything you've got coming up for the site or about the site, since you're the head honcho.
I don't know if I'm the head honcho. I just maintain
the subhead honcho.
Yeah, the subhead honcho. You can find on Twitter at @LRM_exclusive. Like Kyle said, we're making the big change on the podcast network to the Genreverse, and we're trying to add more topics of discussions and trying to branch out further on LRM Online. So make sure you keep checking in and, you know, put, you know, questions and things in the comments section so we can keep adding on and keep, you know, expanding this website.
Outstanding. Cam, what about yourself?
Yep. I mean, my main role is the kind of the LRMonline.com actual website itself, writing, you know, stories, making sure that, you know, and really when it comes to that, we have different writers covering sort of different subjects. My main focus is in the big franchises, you know, so the Marvels, the Star Wars, the DC stuff, the, you know, the fantasy stuff that's coming out. So, you know, our job is to just try and get that information, whatever's happening, spoilers, rumors, just breaking news or whatever, and get that out to you guys as quickly as we can, you know, and hopefully with some opinions that go along with it as well.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. Give some tips, make some suggestions for movies. Cam is going to get to choose the movie for August. So I have no idea what he wants to do. The only thing I can think of is, like, do you want to watch like Waterloo or one of the Zulu movies or something?
No, I'm joking around. I'm not actually a fan of a lot of those types of films. I mean, I should have said Braveheart, which was Great War when we won our independence against, you know, England. But, you know, I don't know if I call that a war movie, you know. I suppose it is a war movie.
Yeah, it's a war movie.
But if I'm thinking what my favorite war movies are, they're the stuff from the Vietnam War.
Oh, all right then. Well, stay tuned, guys, and find out what that is. But look forward to Gettysburg next month, and again to the D-Day veterans, those that gave their lives on the beaches behind the enemy lines. Thank you guys. We are humbled. The world is thankful. God bless you all. Thank you guys all for listening. Have a great day. We'll talk to you next time.